Before beginning, I'd like to thank the elders here for inviting me to come up here and share with you in these sessions. Also, I'd like to thank Winford and the elders for making the scheduling change for me. I appreciate it very much, and I hope it hasn't and will not work any hardship on anybody. Also, I'd like to thank Audrey Brady for keeping me these past few nights that I've been in Des Moines. Hers is really a home away from home for me. And I'd like to thank everybody that was involved in producing the lovely and bountiful meal that we have just enjoyed together. And I realize by putting myself in this time slot that I'm probably competing with some of your nap time, but that's all right, too. I really don't mind if you feel a sense of safety and security within the family of God where you can go to sleep for a little while. That's not all totally bad. And I really will understand if that happens. We're going to talk this afternoon about another subject that I was assigned, the oldest institution. In all the centuries since the creation of this world, the God of heaven, who is triune in his nature, being composed of three personalities himself, he has only produced three institutions in all the histories of the world. The first one of these is the one that we're going to be talking about today. But he also produced the church, which we should note in passing because it's one of the institutions that God made. The church he ordained for our salvation. He purchased it with his own blood, and he made it into the body of Christ. Jesus said, "Upon this rock I will build my church. The gates of Hades shall not prevail against the establishment of that church." Matthew chapter 16. He gave us the church for our salvation, and that's one of the institutions. 1,657 years after the creation of the world, God brought Noah out of the ark. And at that time, he made the statement, "Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God created he man." And saying some other things as well, God established at that point civil government as we know it today. Civil government for the protection of the human family. Because in a fallen world, people would not relate to one another well unless they had this mediating influence which God himself created. In the New Testament, we're told that the civil government does not bear the sword in vain, that it's there for a purpose. We're to be subject to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, render unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and even pray for those who are in authority that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in a defiled and fallen world. So God created the church for our salvation. He created the civil government for our protection. But far preceding the church and the civil state, God created the home. The family really was the foundation for these other two institutions that we've talked about, because without the family, these other two could not have ever come into existence. The family is as old as humankind, and according to the Bible, there are at least three purposes for marriage. I mentioned this the other night when we were talking at the marriage ceremony. One of the purposes of marriage is procreation, the begettal of children born of our bodies and the rearing and socializing of those children. Another purpose is to avoid fornication. The same desires are present in our bodies whether we're married or not. And so the apostle says, in order to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife and every woman her own husband. When we're married, we belong to each other and to no other in the flesh. But transcending these two reasons for marriage is the third, and that is the fulfillment of our own personalities as individual people. Marriage is to help that work. And that's the reason, among others, that I think that marriage is going to survive and will be around as long as the human family is here. Back in the early 70s, I can remember, about the time that the major changes and upheavals from the 60s began to be institutionalized in this society, a lot of people thought that marriage was on the way out. They thought that it was going to cease to exist. I can remember hearing people on talk shows say that by the year 2000, marriage is no longer going to exist. And I can remember even people in the church sometimes, and on more than one occasion, would say, "Now, when marriage no longer exists as an institution in this society, will elders in the church still need to be married?" And really serious about that kind of a question, because we were starting to have more than a million divorces a year. More and more people were living together without marriage, and it was felt among a lot of people, some of them even in the church, that marriage would not exist anymore after a while. Many, many people prophesied the total and complete collapse of the home, and that monogamous relationships would be pretty much on their way out. Well, I believe the home is going to survive. There's really very little question about that in my mind, and probably in yours. And one of the reasons is because of this idea of the completion of our personalities. there is something about having this unique relationship with just one other person that can never be replaced. There's a bigger difference between one and two than there is between two and 100. If you've had two wives or you've had 100 wives, that's still polygamy. But if you just got one, if you got this unique, intimate relationship with just one other person, then you've really got something. And this is what God has ordained for us. Somebody said, home is the place where when you go there, they have to take you in. And there's really a lot of truth in that. I think it was Edgar A. Guest, maybe, who made that statement, or Will Rogers one. When you go there, they have to take you in. And there's something about the home that's kind of that way. That's not true of any other establishment in our society. That's not even true in jail. If I were to go down to the jailhouse and ask for a place to sleep, I don't think they'd give it to me. I'd have to go break out the picture window of a jewelry store, and then they'd give it to me. But I couldn't get in just by going there and asking to get in. But the home is different from that. This is where, hopefully, we accept each other as we are, and we can go there when we've got no place else to go. The reason, though, that a lot of people felt like the home was going to collapse is because it gave up a lot of the meaning and the functions that it had in the world back in previous times. Now, I'm not one who feels like that everything that was old was good and everything that's new is bad or at least suspect, but I do think that the home had a lot going for it, in our society at least, a few years ago, above what it has now. There was a time when the home or the family really had an economic relationship to the society. And the idea of household management and everybody pulling together was really very important just for the survival of that family. And children were looked at in a patriarchal agrarian society. They were looked at as an asset rather than as a liability. They were looked at as a blessing, because if you had able-bodied children, the more of them you had, the more work you could get done. And in an economy like this, often when a son in the family got married, the father would give that son a certain portion of land there connecting to the farm, and a home would be built there, and they still stayed together and worked together. Everybody knew what everybody else was doing, and sometimes that caused problems, but there was a real sense of familiarity, of family working together, sharing work, sharing together in the harvesting and in the cooking for the threshers and so on. Now we live in a time where we've come into the cities. In 1795, about 5% of the population of this country lived in the cities, and 95% lived on the farms. In 1920, for the first time, we had an urban majority in this country. And now we've got about 3% of the people on the farms and 97% of the people in the cities. So now we get to the place, and children get to a certain age and they feel like they can only think of going and getting away from home, having their own apartment. If they live in the country, many times they want to go to the city. And sometimes this is almost an economic necessity. And again, I'm not saying that this is bad in and of itself, but I'm saying it makes the family seem less important, less a necessity, less something that is an integral part of the actual fabric, the warp and woof of life. Children are often looked on today as units of consumption rather than as units of production. They're often looked at as liabilities rather than as blessings. And so it seems like to many people that the home is not as important as it used to be. The home, to some extent, has given up the protective function that it used to have. We have a Bill of Rights, which guarantees the citizens of this country the right to bear arms, whatever that means, and I'm not going to enter that discussion today. But it used to be that there was this protective agency of the home, that if a girl was violated, quite often she had brothers who would go and take care of the situation. There were family relationships that had to be honored. Now today, in many instances, the police and the lawyers are involved before you can even talk to the people that you have trouble with. You don't get to talk to the father or the brother of somebody you've got a problem with and try to work things out, but they've got the authorities involved. I was rear-ended in an auto accident a couple of years ago, and the people that were involved in this and were the responsible party wouldn't even talk to me. Talk to our lawyer, they would say. Well, I just wanted to see if we could work something out. Well, just talk to the lawyer. Talk to the policeman. Talk to the authorities, but don't talk to me, because we've got everything codified and institutionalized to the place where we don't have that family relationship as an important factor in what we used to have. It used to be that a man was allowed the right to protect his home and castle. If somebody was trying to break into it, woe unto that man. Now, in many states, the thief actually has to get into the house before he can be legally shot. as an intruder. If he's trying to break in, you have to wait until he breaks in and actually gets into the house. And even sometimes in that circumstance, there have been cases of a thief actually carrying a television out of somebody's house and the man getting shot, and the people who shot him in their own home being prosecuted for shooting a thief in their own home. More and more, there is an infringement against this protective aspect. It used to be that the home and the family was a real source of status. You got your recognition, you got your sense of identity from your family, from who your parents were, who your grandparents had been, because you lived in a community where they had all lived and everybody knew one another. Now we live in a very mobile society where we often don't know the families of the people that were around. And status is no longer gained by being a member of a family in a close-knit community. Quite often kids are ashamed of their families, and especially of their parents today. Status is gained by the way you dress, or the car you drive, or the money that you have. More from possessions, and not so much anymore, from human relationships. The home used to be the place of religious and moral training. When there was no television, people were forced to relate to one another more than they have to now. It was a time when there might often be Bible studies by the family sitting around a hearth. Now, this has kind of been handed over to the church, such as it is. The training program of the church is about the training religiously that a lot of people get, because it's not done so much in the home anymore. It's a tragedy, but it's true. Character is formed in the home, not in the church. The church can't do that, even if the church wanted to, and it probably does want to, but it really can't do it. All character is formed in the home, in the place where we're raised, and by the people that we spend the most time around. This is one of the sad implications of the way so many families operate today. The home used to be the place for education. It was the main source of education for the individual. The main source. A little boy learned an occupation by following his father around and running errands, doing things that were a part of that man's profession. A little girl learned how to be a mother and a wife by following her mother around. Now the kitchen has been moved into the schoolhouse. And again, please understand, I'm not saying that these things are bad in and of themselves. I think home economics courses are great. I think horticultural engineering is great as a major in college. It used to be the boy learned to farm from his dad. Now sometimes the boy goes to school and learns how to do it, then he comes home and teaches his dad because there's been new things learned. And that's not all bad. But it used to be that the home was the important center of education. Maybe you went to school, maybe you didn't. And sometimes you did, sometimes you didn't. But the home was really the place where education was done. Education for practical life. The home used to be the place where recreation was carried out. People would play games with one another. They would tell riddles to one another. They would act out pantomimes and have guessing games with one another. A lot of people today, though, think that you've got to get in a car and go someplace in order to have any kind of fun at all. In fact, a few years ago, they used to say that home is the place where part of the family waits until the rest of the family brings back the car. They don't say that anymore. They don't say it anymore because in most families there's two or three cars, so you don't have to wait until somebody brings it back. But we've turned recreation away from the family and over to worlds of fun and bowling alleys and television, circuses. Again, things not bad in and of themselves, but we lose the fabric of the family and the home life that we used to have. And so this is the reason that people would say, is the home going to survive? It's succumbed in all of these areas. It no longer has the economic meaning that it used to. This has been turned over to business and industry. It doesn't have the protective value. We've got police forces for that now that are readily available with 911. It doesn't give status anymore. That's turned over to possessions. It doesn't have a religious implication like it used to, because that's turned over to the church. It doesn't have education, because that's turned over to the public schools. It doesn't have recreation, because that's been turned over to everything from bowling to Whitewater University. So what are you going to do? What is there that can help the home survive? Well, another aspect that they've never been able to replace is this fulfillment of our personalities as individuals, this third purpose of marriage that transcends simply avoiding fornication or simply bringing children into the world. Being married has to do with making us into everything we can be, made in the image of God. Back in the beginning, when God was creating our environment as the best of all possible worlds in its pristine condition, he said repeatedly, "It is good, it is good, it is good." But then when he saw man alone, he said, "It is not good." So he found the solution to that problem by creating woman. I will make him an help meet for her. Eve's father, God, brought his daughter Eve to Adam, and they became one flesh. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and cleave unto his wife. The marriage ceremony, if it does anything, marks that line of delineation between the leaving and the cleaving. Very important, because a new family is being formed. There is an affection that develops between a husband and a wife when we do it God's way that is unlike any other relationship and pales before any other relationship that we can have. From the mind that produced the wonders of this universe comes the ultimate prescription for harmonious, fulfilled living. It's called the Christian home, and when it functions like it's supposed to, it reveals the love and wisdom of the Creator himself. Whoso findeth a wife findeth a good thing and obtaineth favor of the Lord. You know, the vice president has gotten into a lot of hot water in the past few months by making statements about the family and family values. And I don't know why he's making these statements. The cynic could say that he does it because he knows something that a lot of the people in Hollywood, San Francisco, New York, and Washington don't know. And that is that 70-80% of the people in this country actually agree with what the vice president is saying about home and family values. And the reason they agree with it is because to some extent or the other, they have either experienced this themselves or they have seen the ideal acted out in the lives of parents or grandparents or some loved relative, and they know deep inside that there's no substitute for marriage and that that is the ideal that our Creator has for us. I was asked when this program was being put together to talk a little bit along the lines of this subject on the concept of our relationship with each other in a sexual way. And I realize that it may be uncomfortable for you to hear about that subject, and it's not real comfortable for me to talk about it either, and I think that's healthy. I guess I wouldn't want us to get too comfortable in dwelling on that area too much in our conversation. Maybe it ought to be a little bit embarrassing. But at the same time, it's very difficult to talk about the oldest institution, that of marriage, without considering the sexual side of life. And to put sexuality in the context of spirituality, because I think in marriage these two are very closely connected together. God had something very specific in mind when he made us the way that he did. Now, he thought it all up. This was his idea, to have man and woman opposite in gender and yet connecting physically, emotionally, and in every other way that they could, connecting spiritually and physically as well. God didn't have to do it that way. God could have made us all of one gender and helped us to reproduce in some other kind of way. Or he could have made six different genders and seen to it that six people had to get together to produce a baby instead of just two. He could have done it any way he wanted to, but he did it the way that you and I see and experience. One man, one wife for life. A lot of people look at themselves sexually and they think that God is unfair. Young people in particular can easily be trapped into believing that God just made us sexual beings and then he told us don't. And when you really feel close to somebody and you love them, it's really hard to control yourself. God is unfair when he limits our sexual behavior toward one another. Why does he want us to wait until we've become involved in that oldest institution? Are there any real reasons here, or is God just being mean? All throughout the Bible we see that God is by his very nature a fulfiller. He's not a restrictor unnecessarily. He sees us and our lives as a river. If we were to go back down to the Embassy Suites where a bunch of us were the other night, and we were to take a look at the Des Moines River and say, well, it looks all right, but it looks like it's kind of restricted by those banks. Why don't we bulldoze those banks away and let the river just go wherever it wants to? We want the river to be free. It's flowing along, it should be the symbol of freedom. So we're going to let the river be free, just flow wherever it wants to. You take away the banks of the river, you end up with an ugly, stinking marsh, and the beauty is marred and gone. It's only when the river is controlled by the banks that it remains beautiful, and that indeed it even remains a river. God is a fulfiller. He's not a restrictor, unless he needs to be. Every restriction he gives us is for our protection. Everything he gives us is to provide something good for us or to protect us from something that's evil. And so he limits our sexual activity to certain situations In doing so, he's not trying to steal our fun, but to give us the most fulfilled life we can possibly have in the long run. God invented this, remember. It was 100% his idea. He created our bodies. He created our emotions. He created our responses. Satan, the devil, wants us to believe that he's the sex expert. He wants us to believe that he knows more about it than we do. And he's got a lot of fun for us out there if we'll just quit believing God. It really comes down to a question of faith. Do you believe that God knows better how to handle sex, or do you believe that you know better how this should be handled? Which is it? Does God know better, or do you know better? That's really the issue. One of Satan's most convincing lies is that we'll miss something if we do it God's way. In reality, we'll miss something if we don't do it God's way, and an awful lot of people out in the world who are sexually free by their own standards don't know even what God's way is in many cases, and don't know what they're actually missing. A lot of people feel like God is trying to push them into a corner and cramp them there. If you have too much fun or you have too much pleasure, you're not going to be saved and God won't like you anymore. They think God wants you lying on beds of nails to prove that you're really serving him. That's not the way God is, and that's not the Christian faith. God saw you in your mother's womb. He saw you woven and knit together there by his care. God is enthused about the possibilities that you have in this life. He's disappointed by those who are hurting him. But he's also enthused about the potentialities and the possibilities that he sees in every person. He wants the highest possible level of fulfillment for every human being. That is his plan for you in relationship to the opposite sex. Few of us find that very easy to believe. Well, I know what's going to be fulfilling to me better than God does. That's what I tend to say, not actually pronouncing those words, but by my behavior I show that I believe that when I get outside God's boundary lines. A lot of us blow it because we don't understand that God created pleasure, and God created pleasure for us. God wants us to experience pleasure. And this is a very important and biblical point. We can see this when we look at our own bodies and the way they're built. God wants us to experience pleasure. God didn't need to give you taste buds. No real need for those at all. But imagine eating the meal we just shared together without them. You could do without taste buds. And the fact that you have them ought to tell you something about God. Food, in its basic agency, is just something to prepare, to repair and to maintain your body. You don't need to go, over a banana split in order to have your body repaired and maintained. But do you enjoy filling your car with gas? I don't. It seems like every time I turn around, things on empty, I have to stop and pump it in there again. It's not difficult. It just takes a little of your precious time, and you kind of get some of it on me. I usually get it on myself, and I go around smelling like gas the rest of the day. It's just not a pleasant thing to do. I'd rather not have to do it. God could have created me physically the same way, with a little gauge on my wrist that shows when I need some more food, so I just shovel it in there. No taste buds, just hog it down. He could have done that. One gauge to show full or empty, another gauge to show whether what I'm eating is poison or good for me. Could have done that, sure. He could have done it any way he wanted to. But the fact that he gave me taste buds shows me that he wants me to experience pleasure. That may be the main reason taste buds exist. Well, if God is a God of pleasure, if it was his idea, and he wants me to enjoy what I eat, well, then I ought to be able to just go out and eat everything and as much of it as I want, right? Oh, no. If I know that my stomach holds 2 quarts and I eat a whole lot more than that, I'm going to pay the price for that. So it's best that I limit my enjoyment so that everything will go right in the long run. Likewise, we cannot logically reason that because God has given us sexuality, that any amount of it is good at any time and under any circumstances. A lot of the things that many of us learn about the sexual issue, unfortunately, comes from songs and movies and television. We're taught by people who think we are mere animals or just bags of chemicals. Now, it's true that if we're just a bunch of matter, we don't matter. And that it won't matter what we do. We can do anything with anybody at any time. But by contrast, David says we are fearfully and wonderfully made. Your body is so complex, we don't even have time to talk about it. 240 bones, 500 muscles, 10,000 nerves, 100,000 glands, 200 million pores in your skin, any one of which can become infected and any one of which can be responsible for your death if it's not taken care of. We could talk about the body for a long, long time. But you add on to this remarkable mechanism called the body the emotional aspect of life. And then you have a whole other area, a whole other level of life to talk about. And we could go on about the emotions of the human being for a long time. And then we have the spiritual nature of the human being. God has made us spiritual, whereas He has not made the animal so. And He has related to us, spirit to spirit. Well, if Jesus is in my spirit, so my spirit can go to heaven, then surely my body is going to rot in the ground anyway, so it doesn't matter what I do with my body. Right, my body and my spirit are separate? Not at all, because there is an intricate, fine relationship between the body and the spirit. So Paul tells the Corinthians, your body is a container for your spirit and the temple of the Holy Spirit. What you do with your body always touches your spirit. What you do with your body always touches your spirit. So sex, although it may seem physical, is never only a physical thing, as some would have us believe. There is no such thing as just a physical thing. Your spiritual being is always affected. Sex is an intermingling. It's a blending of two entire personalities, body, soul, and spirit. Flee fornication. That's illicit sexual intercourse. Flee fornication. Every other sin that a man commits is outside the body, but he that commits fornication sins against his own body. How? How can you damage your body through sexual involvement? Isn't sex a function that God created your body for? Yes. Well, then how can it be damaged by sexual involvement? Paul is trying to show us there that we are integrated beings, that you can't do something with your body that doesn't touch your spirit. And we damage our beings in every sexual act that's committed outside the limits of God because we become one with somebody else. We become blended and intermingled. And then in a few minutes, we want to tear that connection apart. We tear that oneness apart into two beings again. This rips our mind, our will, our emotions, and our spirit. These things all affect our body in ways that we can't even trace. The mind is damaged because it has memories and knowledge of something that it was never equipped to cope with apart from a lifetime commitment. The will is damaged because it has been bent like a wire against our conscience saying no, and it's made weaker, weaker and weaker. The emotions have been traumatized by pulling back after once being intermingled, and we get a deep wound in our spirit because death is being ministered to us instead of life. Can a man take fire into his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Whoso committeth adultery with a woman lacketh understanding. He that doeth it destroyeth his own soul. God screams to us, no, and we say, God, you just don't understand. You don't understand how unique I am. Oh, yes, He does. He knows exactly who you are through and through. You're the one who doesn't understand. But it seems so right that there's a way that seems right unto a man, the end thereof being the ways of death. God does understand. Remember, it was all His idea. And God is for us. He's not against us. He's for us. But in His love, He wants to prevent us from damaging our lives. How does it sound to say to your love interest, oh, I love you so much, I just feel like I need to damage you? No, we don't think of it in those terms, but yet if we engage in sexual intercourse before it's time, that's exactly what we're doing, whether we intend to or not. We damage each other. Your inner being is damaged in every case, regardless of how mature you are, how committed you are, or how long you've been going with each other, or whether you intend to get married or not. You're damaged. There's always damage, and God doesn't want to see you hurt. And that's the reason for the limitations He places on this. One reason sex outside of marriage is wrong is because there is a lack of commitment. A lot of people say, well, I don't see anything wrong with it as long as you love each other and you're really committed. What difference does a piece of paper make? What difference does a ceremony make? The answer to that is that if you're not married, you're not committed because marriage is the commitment. It's as simple as that. Marriage is a publicly witnessed and binding covenant between a man and a woman. It is not a mere social custom, although the recognized ceremonial forms may differ culturally. In one group, maybe the man and the woman pile up a pile of rocks, and that signifies their commitment to each other. In another group, they build a teepee together, and that signifies their commitment to each other. In ours, we get a license, and we have the vows solemnized. That is the recognized, accepted, and established form in our particular society. But God ordained marriage, and He ordained the nature of the marriage covenant. We recognize the social conventions of man only insofar as they facilitate the nature of the marriage covenant as God ordained it. If the convention in this society that we're living in now was that a young man and a young woman build a teepee together and this signifies their relationship to each other, then that's the way we would do it. We just go along with whatever the society says as long as it does not violate the laws that God has given to us. Suppose the convention in our society was that of polygamy, then that would still be wrong, even if it became the convention in our society, because when God ordained marriage, He ordained the nature of the marriage covenant as one male and one female. He created them in that way. Marriage is a binding, publicly recognized commitment. Nothing else is. In marriage, God fuses two into one. And it has to be a marriage commitment. The Bible does not say, what therefore sex hath joined together. It's what therefore God hath joined together. It's not just a physical joining. It's a spiritual joining of two people. Jesus said to the woman at the well, go call your husband and come back. She said, well, I don't have any husband. He said, that's right. You've said well. You have had five husbands, but the one whom you now have is not your husband. Now, you can have sex without marriage, and she was doing just exactly that. If you can't have sex without marriage, then there's no such thing as premarital sex, is there? Because when you had it, you'd be married. Sex is not the same as marriage. But we're talking about sex because you can't talk about marriage without including this as a part of it. You just can't do it. You can have marriage without sex, but it's very rare. Sometimes there are veterans and others who are paraplegics or people with various, for instance, testicular malformations who have marriage ceremonies and a commitment to another person, but they are unable to engage in sex. These people are just as bound by their vows as anyone else. Some older people who are married late in life enjoy marriage without sex. They have it for companionship. Sex is very much like the Lord's Supper. It doesn't bring you into the relationship, but it is a privilege and a responsibility of the relationship. In baptism, we're contacting the blood of Jesus, and the covenant is contracted. There is a formal agreement. It's understood as such. And that's what is important in marriage as well. When Isaac and Rebekah went into his mother's tent, everybody knew that this was a relationship of commitment being contracted. I don't know what ceremony there was or if there was a ceremony. All I know is that in that civilization at that time, there was the understanding that this was a committed relationship for life. And it certainly was. In sex outside of marriage, there is an intermingling which is ripped apart into two again. It's like the difference between an artificial flower and a real flower. I was sitting downstairs Friday night. We had a little supper down there before the wedding ceremony. And the lady I was sitting next to reached across the table and touched one of the flowers that was lying on the table because she wanted to see whether it was real or not. And it's gotten so you can't tell by looking anymore. You can't tell by looking, and yet there's, in reality, the difference between night and day, between a real flower and an artificial flower, whether you can tell it by looking or not. I don't know how many times people have asked me, well, what's the difference, what my girlfriend and I do and what you and your wife do? Well, certainly the physical act is the same. Certainly they would both look alike, but it's like the difference between a real flower and an artificial flower. There is a difference there, even though you cannot see that difference at first sight. They may look the same, the act is certainly the same, but it's not smart or loving for you to intermingle your whole being together with somebody else who is not committed to you for life. Anything less than marriage is not commitment. You've heard people talk about common law marriage. I used to have more of these than I do now, but young people would come and they would say, well, we're trying to live a natural life away from the confines of society, and if you live together for 7 years, then you're considered married by common law. We're just going to do that. Well, most of those relationships didn't last anywhere near 7 years. I'm thinking of one young lady in particular that was severely hurt in one of those relationships because she didn't understand the man that was telling her that they were going to be common law married after 7 years together. If you really mean it, you should have no qualms about actually going and getting married. Have you ever wondered why Satan is so interested with the sexual side of things? Why does he push sexual sin so hard all over the world? Perhaps it is because sex is not just physical, but it involves the spiritual realm as well. Remember that in Old Testament times, people worshiped the devil through sexual involvement. It's the same today in witchcraft and the occult. Satan becomes a participant of sorts in that. He receives honor from rebellion against God's truth. God has known this all the time. In marriage, he not only joins you, but perhaps even puts some ring of protection around you to keep the powers of darkness from messing around in what God has always wanted to be private and relaxed and guilt-free and fulfilling. It's gotten so now with the disease problem in our country and around the world that the only way you can really, for sure, know that you can have a fulfilled sexual relationship without deadly consequences is to be in a monogamous relationship with a spouse who is also monogamous to you, and you two have never had this relationship with anybody else. This was God's idea all the way along, all the time. Now people are coming to the place in droves where they say, well, all these other things we've done are not good. I'm worried. I hope I haven't carried something over from before that's going to affect myself or my children. If we would have done it God's way in the first place, how many problems we could have saved ourselves. Outside of marriage, even the day before marriage, sex is wrong because Satan still has access to bring in guilt and tension. God's ways are so much more logical and loving. Sex with anyone other than your marriage partner destroys a certain amount of intimacy. We love intimacy and we need intimacy, a sharing with just one other person. If we share ourselves with more than one, in nakedness and in sexual pleasure, we have diluted the intimacy that our whole being craves. The second chapter of Genesis said they were both naked, the man and his wife, and they were not ashamed. The expression is for being totally unzipped with each other. Marriage removes the shame of nakedness, and your nakedness belongs to each other when you're married. Remember what the book of Leviticus said, "The nakedness of thy father's wife thou shalt not uncover, it is thy father's nakedness. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your brother's wife, it is your brother's nakedness." When you're married, your nakedness belongs to each other, to be shared alone in intimacy. God wants the highest pinnacle of fulfillment for us. Don't hold back from one another, emotionally or otherwise, when you're married. How often in marriage we settle for less. Less than a totally unique and creative experience with that one other person to whom we are committed. Sex outside marriage will have an adverse effect on your marriage, even if you marry the same person. I've never known of a couple having problems or difficulties in marriage because they lacked experience sexually when they got married. I've never known of a case like that. Now, sometimes lack of knowledge can be a problem. There are ways you can gain this knowledge. The elder women teach the younger, etc. But you don't need experience. One of the devil's biggest lies is that you need to come to your marriage bed experienced. I have known many, many couples who have had difficulties in marriage because of previous experience, because they were too experienced. It's a great lie that says you need experience to be married. Actually, it puts a weight on you that you can well do without, and there are many marriages every day that collapse under that weight. People will say to me, well, I feel guilty. I feel dirty and used. I just can't feel right about it. We got off on the wrong foot together. And so they did. So what are they going to do about it now? It becomes to the place where it's not enjoyable because it's associated with wrongness, because it used to be wrong. How come it's right now? Often there's fear. I just feel like something terrible is going to happen to my baby because of what I used to do, she will say. Or will my teenager do what I did? He wants to know. And what could you say to people who have already gone against the will of God? It's not a pleasant situation. Do you realize that if you are a fornicator before marriage, you will more likely become an adulterer after marriage because you have already learned to cross the line of your conscience against the will of God? Do you realize that a lot of people suffer from severe flashbacks of previous sexual experiences that they have had with other people? These are fixed in the frontal lobe of the brain. Everything that was seen and heard is recorded and stored away there and cannot be easily forgotten. Are you aware of how plagued so many people are by comparisons? I wonder if I'm as good as she was for him. I wonder if he likes me as well as he liked her. If we do it God's way, there's nobody to compare to. We have a unique, intimate relationship that's beautiful. If we don't do it God's way, we can get into a situation where the worse something is, the more exciting it is. Oh, we don't. We shouldn't. But then we do. And we're perverting our responses. We now start to look for something else that's wrong to excite us when the initial excitement wears off. Now that we're married, everything is okay, and so it becomes boring. Perish the thought of that. Because sex is the sharing of entire beings, the more partners and the more experiences we have outside of the marriage container, the more pieces of ourselves we're giving away and the less fulfillment we will end up with. The wounding brings a shallowness to our emotions, and we don't draw as much from the well as we have expected to or as God intended that we should, because we took the bulldozer down to the river and we dozed the banks away, and we don't have a river anymore. We have an ugly, muddy marsh. Say no to destruction. Say yes to God and to His logical, loving limits. Once we understand why God said what He said, maybe it won't be as hard for us to control ourselves. You know, it's not the person who is experienced with many sexual partners or many relationships in life that I admire. It's the individual who has stuck through thick and thin with one other person that I want to go to for advice. They are the wise ones. They are the ones who really know what's going on, and not the one who has had all these experiences with so many different people. One of my favorite Tom Woody quotes is something he said this summer down at the study at Lee Summit, and he attributed it to somebody else, but I don't know who he stole it from. I'll just attribute it to him, and I hope I can get it close to right. He said, if a man can understand just one woman, he's pretty well equipped to understand almost anything. I think there's a lot to that. Who was clapping over there? There's just an awfully lot to that. Those of us who were married got married with such high hopes. Otherwise, we wouldn't have done it. We shared high expectations together, or we wouldn't have been marrying. And we were committing ourselves to a unique, intense and intimate need-meeting relationship in each other. What we need to do from now on in these marriages of ours is to more and more become aware of each other's needs and meet them. That sounds so easy, but it's so difficult to do. Because while men and women have the same basic needs, they don't have them in the same order of priority. And quite often, as spouses, we attempt to give to the other person what we ourselves would like. But a woman often does not like what a man likes, and vice versa. So, being heirs together as the grace of life means that I dwell with her according to knowledge, as the Apostle Peter put it. Dwelling with her according to knowledge means that I find out not only what her needs are, but the order of priority of those needs. And then I set about to meet them. And I may not understand why she has those needs or why she has them in the order that she does, but I do understand that she does have them and that she has them in that order. And once I come to that conclusion, then I'm not going to give her the things that I would like for her to give me. There is a little limitation to that statement, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That needs some explanation in marriage. Quite often a wife will give her husband the kind of little gifts that she or herself would like to receive. And he says, oh, that's nice, thanks, and puts it down. It doesn't mean much to him at all. But she's doing it because she thinks this is the way you please somebody, because that's what I'd like to receive. So I'll do it for him. This is the way I express love to him. There may be something else that he would much rather have her do for him. And the same is true on the other side as well. Learning to know one another. That's why I like that statement so much. If I can just understand that one woman, that's really about all I need to understand. And so much beauty and loveliness will flow in and through my life because of that level of understanding. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her. Become aware of each other's needs and learn to meet them. All of us in our marriages have to recognize that they're not ideal. But we hope, instead of having ideal marriages, that we will have real marriages as God intended them. If I want to make my marriage any better in the future than it is right now, I have to recognize that change begins with me. Who was it? Benjamin Franklin, who said that having a successful marriage consists of keeping your eyes wide open before you're married and then half shut afterward. Somebody else said, and I may have even been the one who said this, I'm not sure. Sometimes I don't know where they come from. But that before marriage, I want to focus on finding the right one. But after marriage, I need to focus on being the right one.